The Science Show on RN, where we now cross the continent to Cairns for even smaller creatures, but not at all so lovable. Let's join Peter Hadfield and Associate Professor Laurie Lack at James Cook University, Northern Queensland.
The yellow crazy ant problem, people wouldn't have heard of it. We've all heard of red fire ants, but why should we be worried about yellow crazy ants?
Yellow crazy ants are one of these few species of ants in the world that can become really invasive. They can build up to really high numbers and have pretty dramatic impacts on our native ecosystems. They had been on Christmas Island since at least the 1930s and hadn't been doing much. People didn't really take notice of them. And then around late 80s, early 90s, suddenly their population density really increased quite a bit. The going hypothesis is that coincided with the introduction of a scale insect that produce honeydews. So they'll come and they'll consume that honeydew. And in doing so, they'll be protecting the scale from any predators or parasitoids that might be wanting to attack that scale. So the scale population also increases too then. It's a mutualism. Sap-sucking pests are not at high levels until they're being tended by ants. So farmers obviously very aware of potential effects of yellow crazy ants that way. And you can imagine if that's happening in a banana plantation or sugarcane or mangoes or something like that, then you're going to see decreased yields. Environmental impact is huge. You know, we're sitting here in World Heritage Rainforest, so we could expect some direct impacts on our native fauna. They can also be a real nuisance. If you have these in your backyard, you will probably not want to do a whole lot of gardening. Your pets could be affected. Most people think, oh, ants, neat little trails, and this is where the yellow crazy ant.
If you've never heard of yellow crazy ants, remember the name. They could be the next big pest to hit Australia. Their colonies move and split easily. They're very efficient at protecting that other Australian pest, sap-sucking insects. And what makes them dangerous to our wildlife is that they're much better than other ants at spraying formic acid to blind and then kill their prey. So their habits are now being intensively studied, as Professor Laurie Lack showed me when we ventured into the laboratory near her office, where thousands of them are kept.
Thank you very much. Oh, you're right, it is hot in here.
Yes, so it's 26 degrees, which is a pretty good temperature for the ants. And it's also on a light-dark cycle.
So we're looking at these sort of metal shelving with all kinds of plastic containers.
Probably at our peak, we've had 150 colonies in here.
Are we able to have a look at one of the colonies? At the risk of starting a new infestation, I will leave you to handle them. So Laurie's just taking down one of the boxes now.
What I'm going to do, though, is just set up.
Oh, put this in water. Very good.
Yep.
So we've put a little bit of soap in that, and that breaks the surface tension,
exactly.
Makes it much harder to swim.
These off the cover.
Gosh, there's lots of them. They're just crammed in there.
So this is, you get more of a sense of, A, why they're called crazy, because they just start running. Now,
you're getting a lot on your hand there.
Yep. And I'll just keep tapping. And they're just running around. Again, I've disturbed them, so I have this coming. The worker ants themselves can't consume the solids, so they'll have to take that to the larvae, feed it to the larvae, and the larvae will digest it, regurgitate it. And workers share liquid sugar foods among themselves via this mechanism too. Right. You know, they'll just regurgitate to each other's mouths. And we use that behavior against them when we're baiting them, because what we need them to do is to come back. The only part of the colony will be out foraging at any time, right? So if you have a technique, spraying or something, that just knocks out those workers, well, then you've only killed that part of the colony. So what you need is a mechanism that is going to be slow acting enough that they don't die right away, carry it back to the nest, spread the food around, and then over several hours or days, then the colony is affected. We all look to the Northern Territory, and what Ben Hoffman from CSIRO has done in a regional containment program. So again, they weren't going for eradication at select eradication at specific sites. He had worked out three treatments a year, 3 months apart, and some combination of fipronil, which is a neurotoxin and is relatively fast-acting, and insect growth regulators. There's also all of the issues with how bait is applied. So over large areas, it's dropped by helicopter. So when you're talking about a rainforest, then how much of the bait is actually getting to the ant? So that's been something that we've had to look at. But then there are other areas that need to be treated by hand, and so there can be obstacles there as well.
Good. We might stand back here because the activity's going.
Oh, right. That way. Carl has got his head buried down in the soil. You look like you're enjoying yourself down there.
Enjoying myself, yes.
So what we're looking at, we've got six bait spots here of blue food, I suppose, as far as the ants concerned.
Yeah, so when they find the crystals and they fill themselves up and they have a bright blue bum, really, and then it makes them easier to track. Kind of tricky to see, but there's one here.
Gosh, you need a good eye, don't you? Oh, yeah, I can see. It is blue.
Yeah.
And the idea here is to be able to see how far they're willing to travel for that food resource. That foraging distance might determine, for example, how closely do you need to apply bait to a colony to have confidence that it's going to actually take up the bait. And we're in a riparian habitat here, so very distinct from the cane habitat, which is just a few meters away. Lots of leaf litter, some seedlings growing up, and lots of rocks and close proximity to water.
Right.
Yellow crazy ants love this habitat. So this is where detection becomes the name of the game, and where we've put effort into trying to figure out, well, how detectable are they with that luring method versus with, say, a sticky trap, which is another method we tested. The detectability is still much lower than we'd want.
I'm Gareth Humphreys, Senior Technical Officer with the Wet Tropics Management Authority's Yellow Crazy Ant Eradication Program. The ants on their own, particularly at very, very low numbers, are very hard to detect just by going through and looking for them. So that's where the dogs come into their own with their incredible sense of smell. So with the dog work, this is more about looking at areas that we've treated and looking for the last patches and the remnants, rather than large areas of infestation. When we see those large areas, the whole ground is busy with ants. They're very easy to find. So this is about finding those remnant patches. Then we can come in and we can really target, rather than applying pesticide over large areas.
So she's off already, Gareth?
Yep, absolutely. She's a very high drive dog. And what you'll see is she works along the cane. When she comes across what she thinks is ants, she'll stop and she'll scratch at it. And then when she's definitely sure that she's hit the crazy ants, she'll actually lie down on the ground and wait for Stuart to come along and check. Once he comes and confirms that she's found the ants, then it's all on with the ball, and that's what she lives for. She lives for the ball and to play, and that's her reward for finding the ants.
And now that's what she's doing now, so she must have just found something then.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, she obviously loves it. Here she goes. So now she's looking again. She's hunting in there.
She's a fast mover, and one of the great things with the dogs is they can move so much faster than field staff who have to put down lures for the ants.
And it doesn't take very many ants for her to be able to spot them, I gather.
Just one or two.
Wow.
One or two ants is enough. It's actually more difficult for her when there's a lot of ants around because she's surrounded by the scent and they're everywhere. When it's just a patch here and a patch there, that's where she excels.
You are winning this war, are you?
Yeah. Look, there's a couple different ways to measure that. Where yellow crazy ants are no longer being detected where they were in large numbers. And so a few of the areas, especially ones that were the earlier ones in the program, and especially the ones that were really threatening the World Heritage Area boundary, we're at the point now where it doesn't make sense to survey them every year because they're not going to pose much of a threat. And we're at the point now where if they're still there, we need to give them a bit of time to just get to slightly higher populations so they can be detected and figure out where they are, and then just spot treat that area.
Quantifying a win is difficult. Containment seems to be working in the Cairns area, but that hasn't stopped yellow crazy ants from spreading to other parts of Queensland, even as far south as Lismore in New South Wales. So the Queensland government is working hard to get the problem under control. If they can't, then the threat to the state's tourism and agriculture sector could run into tens of billions of dollars. For The Science Show, I'm Peter Hadfield in Cairns.
Thanks, Peter. He was with Associate Professor Laurie Lack.